and for the rest of her life, for reasons she could never explain, they stayed with her. A bride in a dress, two men fishing, a gentleman walking through an empty home, Congress people debating, a redheaded girl with a redheaded boy, somebody standing in a field of blue flowers, a cartoon of Superman flying, a movie about war with soldiers climbing over a low stone wall. She left the last one on and watched as they advanced on the opposition. It looked like it was meant to be World War II, and the troops looked like they were meant to be British. David liked war movies. Ada knew about war. She watched the entire film, and then she began to watch the next one, which was its sequel, when suddenly she noticed someone standing next to her, in her peripheral vision. She kept her face turned very straight ahead, for she knew that it was one of Liston's older boys, and the possibility that it was William made her stiffen with nerves.
"What are you watching?" said the boy.
He had a low voice, much as she remembered William's voice sounding. "I don't know," Ada whispered.
"You like this movie?" he asked.
"I don't think so," she whispered. But he must not have heard her because he said,
"You can't talk?"
Ada's voice had been taken from her, so she only shook her head. She could recall for the rest of her life the very particular feeling she had at that age when asked to interact with a peer. It often seemed as if her voice had retreated into her stomach, which then clenched it very tightly and held it deeply inside of her, and wouldn't release it until she was alone once more. Ada shifted her eyes as far to the left as they would go and made out a boy in a blue t-shirt with his hand on the back of the sofa. She let herself turn her head ever so slightly to more closely inspect his arm, which was sturdy and tan, and his hand at the end of it, which had nails that were very severely bitten, down to the part that hurts. She did not look up at his face. Then he took his arm away, and then he took himself away, out of the room. She breathed out heavily. She was alone again. At a certain point, she could smell and hear Liston microwaving something, probably making dinner, and she knew then that it would be polite to go in and ask her if she needed help. But she was frightened of encountering any of the boys again, so she stayed where she was on the sofa. She was expecting a cry from Liston. "Dinner," she might say, and the boys would come rushing to the kitchen. But it never came. Instead, Liston poked her head into the TV room and asked if she wanted to eat there or at the table.
"Either," Ada said.
And Liston winked at her and said maybe the two of them should eat at the table, like civilized people. "David would be appalled if I let you watch too much TV." Ada followed her into the kitchen and watched as from the microwave Liston pulled two frozen meals. "Dining in," said the packages on the counter. "Salisbury steak dinner."
"Where are the boys?"
Ada asked, before she thought better of it.
"Oh, they fend for themselves mostly," said Liston lightly. "They don't like my cooking."
Ada was surprised. She had imagined somehow that everyone in this family ate together all the time. She had liked to imagine it that way. They talked about anything but David. The latest gossip from the lab, the problem Liston was working on. At one point, Maddie came in and asked Liston if he could watch television, now that she's not watching. And Liston told him all right for 15 minutes, but then he had to get ready for bed. Soon there was a knock at the door. Her heart surged. It was David, she thought, at last. But Liston looked as if she had been expecting one.
"William!"
she called loudly, without turning around. Her oldest son came running down the stairs and around the corner into the kitchen, and Ada, for the first time, allowed herself to look fully at his face, which was more handsome than she had remembered it. She looked away again quickly. He opened the door and said nothing. A girl his age came in and shut the door behind her. She was tall and skinny, with blonde hair and an arc of sideways bangs, and she wore a shirt that hung off her shoulder,
a bra strap showing itself assertively. She wore high heels, too. Ada thought she was pretty, but not quite as good-looking as William.
"Hey, Miss Liston," said the girl. And Liston said, "Hello, Karen," but didn't look up.
William and Karen went upstairs together.
"That door better be open when I come upstairs," Liston called after them.
When Ada finished her dinner, she was not sure where to go. So she very quietly picked up her fork and rinsed it at the sink, and then opened the dishwasher, but she wasn't certain whether to put it on the top or the bottom. David and she did not have a dishwasher.
"Just leave it in the sink, honey," said Liston.
When Ada turned around, Liston was looking at her, arms crossed. She glanced at the clock on the wall and back again. It was 9 o'clock at night.
"Should we try David one more time?" asked Liston,
and Ada said yes, gratefully. She had not wanted to be the one to ask, but when she called her home number, no one was there.
"I think I'll go to bed now," said Ada. She was not tired, but it seemed the most out-of-the-way thing to do.
"Okay," said Liston.
She put her hands on her hips for a moment and regarded her.
"We're glad you're here," she said,
and it made Ada buckle for reasons she couldn't explain.
"Come here," said Liston.
She brought Ada to her and kept her in her arms. Ada had rarely in her life been hugged, and she stiffened.
"It'll be all right," said Liston. "You'll be just fine."
She did not, however, say that David would return. The bedroom Liston put Ada in was decorated in shades of red and blue and green. It contained a small Legoland that someone had labored over in the corner, and a twin bed with a frame shaped like a race car.
"This is Maddie's room," said Liston, "but I've thrown him in with Gregory for the night."
Ada did not like the idea of Maddie's being thrown anywhere because of her, but Liston assured her that he would like it.
"He'll get a kick out of it," she said. "He's obsessed with his older brothers."
"Can I get you anything else?" Liston asked.
"A glass of water?
The bathroom's down the hall."
Ada said that she was fine, and Liston put one hand on her head and looked at her, and told her again that it would be all right. Then she left her alone in Maddie's room. Liston's house was built so much like David's that Ada knew where she was going without asking. She got out her toothbrush and changed into her nightgown. She walked toward the bathroom at one end of the dim upstairs hallway, and she passed an open door on her way there. She looked into the room as she did, and inside of it she saw William and Karen kissing on the bed. For one moment, she froze. Trying to decide, perhaps, whether to retreat to her room or advance to the bathroom, and she stared. She had never seen a real-life kiss before, and the heads of the parties involved moved about in a surprisingly vigorous way. In the movies Ada had seen, old-fashioned ones that David and she watched together, the heads of the protagonists stayed coolly in place at an elegant angle as they embraced. Suddenly, William looked up and saw her.
"What the hell?"
he shouted. He stood up and slammed the door.
"Oh my God, Will,"
she heard Karen say.
"She came out of nowhere," she heard William say.
Ada burned with embarrassment. She looked down at her plaid nightgown. It had ruffled wrists and a ruffled hem, and was befitting of a much younger child, or an old lady. She stood in place and thought about what she had done for a time. And then, afraid that William would fling open the door again, she continued to the bathroom, where she brushed her teeth with her finger and with toothpaste she borrowed from the Listons, having forgotten her own. And then she took her glasses off and splashed cold water on her face and patted it dry with someone else's towel, which smelled like cologne and was stiffer than it should have been. After that, she walked quickly back to her room, looking straight ahead in case William's door was open again, and closed the door behind her. She stood in place for a while, breathing. She was not tired yet, and everyone else was still awake. She stayed up late into the night in Maddie's room, reading one of the 7 books that she had brought along with her, and eventually succumbing to the temptation of the hundreds of Legos in a bucket in the corner. They had been her favorite when she was younger, and a favorite of David's, too. And assembling a little castle with a drawbridge, a king, and a princess. When finally she went to bed, it was difficult to fall asleep. She missed their house, and she missed David. To comfort herself, she imagined the worlds that were orbiting inside of every closed door along the hallway. Maddie and Gregory in Gregory's room, breathing slowly in and out as they drifted toward sleep. And William and Karen kissing violently on William's bed. And the sheets and towels resting in the linen closet, and the spiders in the basement spinning their webs, and every small living thing in the house, the dust mites, the gnats, and the water dripping out of the bathroom sink, and below her, Liston, old friend, scratching away at her yellow pad on work for the Steiner Lab, which was their second home. And she wondered about David, where he might be. In her mind, she went through the steps of their after-dinner ritual, which began while Ada cleaned up the dishes. Next, she would go and stand outside David's office. His door was always open, but a sort of impenetrable field surrounded him if he was working. Since the time she was small, she had known the importance of never interrupting him. So she would press her head into the door frame and stand on the edges of her sneakers and wait, and wait. And then, finally, he would turn to her and smile, as if waking from a dream. "Let me explain something to you," he would say. And then they would sit together at the dining room table and start on a lesson, one of the many thousands that he taught her in her life. When she asked him a question that he thought was intelligent, he slapped one hand down on the table in celebration. "That is exactly the question to ask," he told her. When she asked him a question that revealed some chasm in her learning, some gap where a concept should have existed, he put his head in his hands, as if trying to summon the energy to explain all that would need to be explained to her to make her fully formed. But he didn't despair. He started from a point that was more rudimentary than he thought necessary. Generally, it was, in fact, necessary, and proceeded from there, his graceful geometrical hands drawing diagrams on the pads of paper that he collected from conferences and hotels and then hoarded in his desk. He often said he could not speak without a pen in his hand. He waved with his pen, pointed with it, scribbled absent-mindedly when on a telephone call. He drew funny things like flowers and birds when he was talking to Ada, and sometimes during her lessons. For the rest of her life, Ada did this too. She adopted many of David's habits. They were alike, everyone said it, and that he understood her more than anyone else in the world ever understood her seemed to her like an incredible stroke of luck. "You are more machine than human, Ada," he said at times. And it was the truth, not an insult. And it was calming to her to be so understood. And sometimes she felt it was why he loved her. She thought of this image as she tried to fall asleep. She pictured herself with David at his desk, the two of them bowing their heads together, their minds a Venn diagram. Ada's mind full of childish trivia, and David's full of the mysteries of the universe, and the center between them growing, growing. In these moments, he was Zeus to her, and she, Athena, springing fully formed from the head of her father, alight with grace and wisdom. There they were at the lab or at home, the two of them, always the two. There they were, solving whatever problem it was that she was facing. In the morning, Ada was woken from a dream about David by the sound of the bedroom door creaking slowly open. There in the doorway stood Maddie, holding a canvas tote bag and observing her. She sat up in bed and rubbed her hands over her face.
"I just have to get some stuff out of here," said Maddie, and then he came in and gathered up all of his Lego people and parts, two books, a small portable radio with trailing wire. All of this he stuffed into his canvas bag, looking sideways at her as he did. He sidled toward her before he left the room. He said to Ada,
"Where's your dad?"
She lifted her shoulders and lowered them slowly. She kept her face very still. Then he turned on his heel and closed the door firmly behind him. Ada heard him running down first one and then another flight of stairs into the basement, she assumed. Ada rose and tiptoed to the door and put her head out into the hallway. It was a Sunday, and everyone else seemed to be asleep still. As quietly as she could, she descended the stairs and went into the kitchen, where Liston's work was sprawled out over the table, and a yellow phone was mounted to the wall. She lifted the receiver from its cradle and dialed the number for her and David's house, holding her breath while the rings came. 4 in a row. 5. 10. Nobody answered. Then, hanging up the telephone, she pondered her options. It still felt odd to be in Liston's house for almost the first time after so many years of knowing her. She had no idea about Liston's habits or her daily routines. No idea, for example, whether she was an early riser on weekends or preferred to sleep late. And no idea what she did when she was not at work and not with David. If Ada had been at home with David, she would have known what to expect from her weekend. David would have stayed in his home office for most of the day, breaking for every meal. Ada would have read or worked on the assignments that David gave her. Some weekends they did something different and interesting. A trip to a nearby mountain for skiing in the winter, for example. Or in the summer, a trip to a cabin in upstate New York that David had been renting since the 50s. Or some other excursion to a nearby town or city. Sometimes they went to Washington, D.C. David had a friend there named George, an artist, one of the few people he had kept in touch with from his childhood. He also went on several work trips a year, to conferences in locations as mundane as Cleveland and as far-flung as Hong Kong. These counted as their vacations. Typically, they would stay a few extra days in every place, seeing more than they otherwise would have. Sometimes, if he'd be in meetings all day and he thought that Ada would have nothing to do, he went by himself to conferences. On these occasions, he paid the division secretary, Martha, to stay with Ada at the house on Shawmut Way and returned as quickly as he could. And there were, of course, the yearly trips to New York City, always in winter, always to see the Christmas concert at Calvary Episcopal. On those same trips, they would see an opera or a ballet at Lincoln Center and visit the Met and walk in Central Park. David always reserved the same accommodations, 2 adjacent rooms on the 3rd floor of a bed and breakfast in Brooklyn Heights.
"Manhattan is overpriced," he always said,
though Ada secretly wondered if he wished to limit, as much as possible, his chances of running into acquaintances from his past. Owned by a charming, fragile septuagenarian named Nan Rockwell. She served scones for breakfast and talked with David about classical music until late into the night, playing on her turntable famous recordings that she sought out and traded for like cards. Always they had dinner at a little cafeteria near Union Square, a nondescript place that David said reminded him of his youth, for reasons he did not explain to Ada. Ada did not think Liston had any interest in doing these things. She came on most of the work-related trips that David and Ada took, but kept to herself, proclaiming her hatred for hotel rooms and her love of home. In her tastes, she was polite but not adventuresome. She hopefully scanned every English-language menu they were presented with for its blandest, palest dish. Until yesterday, Ada had always imagined that she did cozy things on weekends. Made popcorn, watched movies with her boys, cooked meals with her oldest, Joni, when she stopped by with the baby. How Ada came up with this idea, she was not certain. She had no reason to believe that the scientifically inclined Liston was domestic in any way. She knew that Liston did not like to cook and could not abide housework. She bragged often about raising her boys to be good husbands, assigning the weekly chores on a magnetic whiteboard that she stuck to the refrigerator. Despite this, she still seemed traditional to Ada, in a way that Ada and David were not, and in a way, if she was honest with herself, that she envied. Liston drank Diet Coke. She brought ham and cheese sandwiches to work, on white bread. The sight of them made Ada's mouth water. The idea of Liston's house as a bastion of normalcy and tradition, right down the street, was one that Ada had always kept dear. It seemed somehow to anchor her and David's house physically, in the same way that Liston's friendship with them proved reassuringly to Ada that there was nothing so unusual about her situation after all. It was not until shortly after 9 that Ada noticed any movement upstairs. Upon hearing it, she tiptoed to the downstairs bathroom to hide, in case it was one of the boys. She did not want to greet them before their mother was there to protect her. Ada heard footsteps walking down the stairs and into the kitchen, just as she had done. And then someone picked up the telephone receiver. She could hear it all quite clearly.
"It's Di," said Liston in the other room.
Ada didn't know whom she had called, but she began to describe to the person the events of the day and night before, beginning with Ada's phone call to her. Ada froze. She thought perhaps she should clear her throat or turn on the water to let Liston know she was there, but she was immobilized by shyness and fear. She stood still, clutching herself around the middle.
"She's still at my house. She's upstairs, sleeping," said Liston.
She paused.
"And what if he's not back today? When do we call the police?" said Liston.
"And then? He might get in trouble. It might affect Ada. What if they say he's incompetent?"
"It's a sin," said Liston. "An honest sin."
After Liston hung up, she began to move around the kitchen, opening cabinets. Ada held her breath. She didn't think she could emerge just yet. Liston would know she had heard everything. She decided to wait until Liston went upstairs again, or into a different room, at which point she could make a quick exit and pretend she had been someplace else. Ada sat down on the closed lid of the toilet.
"Incompetent," Liston had said.
It was the word she had used about David. It contrasted with every understanding of her father that Ada had. She put her face into her hands, and at that moment Liston opened the bathroom door and shouted in surprise. She clutched her heart and doubled over.
"Ada," she said. "What on earth?"
"I'm really sorry," said Ada, not knowing what else to say.
"Are you all right?"
Liston asked her, and she nodded. Liston put her hand to her chin as if in thought. She was wearing a blue terry robe that looked perhaps a decade old.
"Did you hear me talking on the phone?" she asked Ada.
And Ada had the urge to lie, but could not do it. Liston would have known. She nodded once more. Liston took in a deep breath and exhaled slowly.
"I'm sorry, baby," she said.
She opened and closed her mouth, as if deciding whether to say more, and then gestured with her head that Ada should follow her into the kitchen, which she did.
"How do you sleep?" she asked.
And Ada said that the bed was very comfortable and that she had slept excellently, though it wasn't true.
"Are you hungry?"
Liston asked, and she nodded. On the kitchen counter was a line of boxed cereals with a gallon of whole milk at the end.
"Bowls there, spoons there,"
Liston said, pointing. What David called cereal was hot and eaten with brown sugar. Ada had never before had cold cereal, and she inspected her options carefully, searching for the one that David would be least likely to bring into the house. At last, she chose one called Smacks because of the happy frog on the box, one arm extended skyward, proudly presenting its bounty. While she ate, she waited for Liston to speak. She had settled down at the kitchen table, where her papers were still spread out from the night before, and was working out some problem with her pen, as if solving it would help her answer the larger question facing them. Handwritten code blossomed across the page. At that moment, a great longing came over Ada for David and for their home. Every so often, Liston looked up at her and smiled, but she did not speak, as if waiting for Ada to confess something, some information she had previously kept to herself. But Ada had none.
"Are you going to church today?" Ada asked.
She knew that Liston was an active member of the parish just over the bridge, and often on Sundays she had seen Liston marching there and back again with her boys, who were always dressed in ill-fitting khakis, button-down shirts, loose ties, scuffed and poorly knotted shoes. It occurred to her that day that Liston was not dressed for it. She did not wish to be the cause of any change in plans.
"We'll skip it today," said Liston, smiling. "The boys will be thrilled."
She put her pen down and then looked out the window. She spoke without shifting her gaze.
"What have you noticed, Ada?" she said.
"What do you mean?"
Ada asked. She hated this. The feeling of being asked to betray David.
"About your dad," said Liston. "Has he been acting differently? Has he said anything strange?"
"I think he's just under a lot of stress," Ada said.
And Liston nodded noncommittally. Both of them were silent, and then both spoke at the same time. Ada said, "I think he'll be all right." And Liston said,
"Honey, I think we should call the police."
Ada thought of David's mistrust of law enforcement, his vehement disapproval of the meddlesome state, his passionate dedication to privacy. And then she decided that whatever fear he had of the police, hers was greater of losing him.
"All right," she said,
and immediately felt unfathomably disloyal. Treacherous. She lowered her head. Ada disliked the two police officers who arrived later that afternoon. She couldn't help it. Her well had been poisoned by David's mistrust of authority. One was tall and thin. The other was short and thin. Both had mustaches.
"And the last time you saw him was?"
asked the tall one, Officer Gagnon.
"And has he been acting unusual?" he asked. "And do you have any idea where he might be?" he asked. He seemed bored. Both accepted Liston's offer of coffee and then sipped it loudly.
"You're the daughter?"
asked the shorter one, finally, and Ada said yes. "And how do you two know each other?" he asked, gesturing back and forth between Liston and her with his pen.
Liston explained, and the two of them looked at each other.
"We'll have to get social services in here," said Officer Gagnon, "since there's no relation."
"Really, are you sure?" said Liston. "I've known her since she was born."
"Sorry, ma'am," said Gagnon. "Just procedure. They'll be over soon."
It was then, for the first time, that Ada let her imagination run its terrifying course. She was an impressionable child, and she thought of what ruins might await her. She had read too much Dickens. Did workhouses still exist? Before they left, Maddie came into the kitchen. The suddenness and quietness of his appearance gave Ada the impression that he had been eavesdropping on them from someplace nearby, and looked shyly at the officers.
"Hey, big guy," said Gagnon on his way out.
"Hey,"
said Maddie, softly, but the door was already closed. There was little to say for quite some time. Ada sat still at the kitchen table, pretending to read a newspaper, until at last Liston said it must be close to dinner time, and stood up and went to the cupboards. She opened them one at a time, looked inside them beseechingly. At last, she pulled down a blue box of spaghetti and some canned tomato sauce and opened both, started a pot of water.
"Are you all right?"
Liston asked Ada at one point, and Ada nodded. But the truth was, of course, that she was not. Would not be until David had returned. If he returns at all, she thought, and put her chin in her hands to keep it from trembling. She stood up from the table abruptly. She had never cried in front of Liston before, and she didn't wish to now.
"I think I should get a few more clothes from my house," said Ada,
and walked quickly out the door before Liston could follow her or agree. She inhaled deeply, willing herself to calm down. Outside, it was beautiful. It had cooled off slightly for the first time that August. In the distance, the low hum of a lawnmower started. One of the neighbors was barbecuing. The smell of burning charcoal and meat, the particulates of matter that found their way to her on a pleasant breeze, normally signaled happiness and relaxation to Ada. Ever since learning about neurotransmitters from David, she had imagined her brain as a water park, a maze of water slides down which various chemicals were released. Charcoal and smoke and fresh-cut grass usually sent rivers of serotonin down the slides in Ada's head, as she pictured them. But that night, the scents only served to remind her of David's absence. Warm summer evenings, he always said, were his favorites too. Ada let herself in through the kitchen door and poured a glass of water from the tap. She took it with her to her room at the top of the stairs and gazed out the window, and then felt drawn to the old computer at her little desk. She turned it on. She dialed into the Elixir program. She began to type. There was something comforting in the familiarity of Elixir's responses, the small turns of phrase she recognized as having come from the colleagues at the lab. "Where is David?" she typed. And Elixir said, "That's really a very good question." An answer that reminded her, in fact, of David's syntax. There was a great deal to tell Elixir. It had only been 2 days since their last conversation, but it felt like it had been much longer. She looked at the clock after 20 minutes, and fearing that Liston would worry, shut down the program and then the computer, which gave a long, sweet sigh as it went to sleep. It was then that she thought she heard someone moving downstairs. She held her breath, listened for several more seconds. A drawer opened someplace deep in the house. The basement, she thought. Footsteps. Someone dropped something on the floor. Someone began to walk up the basement stairs. Ada was easily frightened as a child, and she sat frozen in place, clutching her water glass, terrified to move. She eyed the window, measuring whether she could jump out of it if necessary. She decided at last that the thing to do was to ascertain the identity of the other person in the house as quickly as possible so that, if necessary, she could make her escape. "David?" she called out, loudly, bravely. There was no answer. She tensed, prepared to run. "David!" she called again. "Hello," said David, his voice warm and familiar. "Is that you, Ada?" She went limp. All of her muscles contracted and then relaxed. She had not realized the weight of the fear she had been holding in her gut, the tension of it. She felt as if she were breathing out completely for the first time in her life. Her face was crumpled and red when she descended the stairs and met her father in the kitchen. He paused with a hand on the wall. He was holding a notepad in his other hand, and he had one of his contraptions, which looked something like ski goggles, pushed back on his head.
"Good grief," said David. "What's the matter, Ada?"
The look he wore was a sort of perplexed smile, as if they were about to discover a grand misunderstanding that they would look back on one day and find comical.
"Where have you been?" she lamented. "Where did you go?"
Her voice must have conveyed a very particular emotion. It was anger at David's betrayal of her trust. From the time she was small, she had felt it whenever she was embarrassed in public, with him by her side. While skiing, for example, if she fell down and, in the tangle of her equipment, could not immediately get up.
"Help me,"
she would mutter to David under her breath. She always sensed, somehow, that it was his fault she had fallen down. She felt the weight of others' stares upon her, seethed in her own embarrassment, converted it into anger at her father. He seemed so well equipped to deal with anything, so utterly competent, and this made her feel that it was his responsibility to preempt and prevent any mistake, any humiliation, not just for himself, but for her. Standing in the kitchen, staring at her prodigal father, she felt the same emotion, only stronger. Thinking of what she would have to tell Liston, what Liston would invariably tell her boys. In that moment, Ada knew for the first time she could no longer hope to protect David from Liston's judgment, from anyone's judgment. As she had been doing, if she was honest with herself, for over a year. David had not answered her yet. He was looking at her in a hazy, puzzled way.
"David,"
she said again.
"I told you," he said finally, speaking carefully, measuring his words. "I told you I was going out of town for work."
As an adult, when Ada tried to recall her father's face, it was often and regrettably this version of him that she thought of. David looking mad, ski goggles pushed back on his head, his shirt sleeves rolled up. There was little connection to David as he normally was. Placid, reserved, attentive. This David was growing increasingly stubborn with every additional question he was asked. He had been in New York City, he said, meeting with the chair of the computer science department at NYU. Ada tried to convince him to come back with her to Liston's, but he wouldn't. She studied him for a moment.
"Really, this is silly, Ada," he told her. "A simple misunderstanding. I'm in the middle of an experiment."
He held forth the notepad he was carrying as if by way of explanation, pointed to the device on his head.
"Wait right here, then," said Ada, and she ran to get Liston.
Inside Liston's house, Liston was pouring the pasta into a colander in the sink. Steam rose up from the boiling water and wilted her hair.
"He's back," Ada told her. "He says he was out of town for work. He says he told me. Maybe I forgot."
It pained her to say it. Liston looked at Ada uncomprehendingly for a moment and then followed her out the door, down the street to her house. By the time they reached David, he was back in the basement, bent over the device he had been wearing, turning into place a tiny screw.
"Shh, shh, shh,"
he said, as Liston began to speak.
"Honestly, David," said Liston, "enough of this."
He straightened and then looked wounded.
"You've been gone for almost 48 hours," said Liston. "Where were you?"
"I was in New York for work," he said slowly. "For heaven's sakes, I wasn't gone long at all."
But his face was changing.
"What work?"
she asked him. He looked down at the workbench, spun the device on the table in a full circle. Liston folded her arms.
"It's time to tell Ada," said Liston. "David, do you hear me?"
They brought Ada to the living room to deliver the news. Later, she recalled wondering, perversely, if this is what it was like to have both a father and a mother. They sat together across from her. She was on a little chair that David said had come from his grandmother. They were on a leather sofa that David attended to from time to time with an oil that smelled like lemons. David looked at Liston for help, but she shook her head. He cleared his throat.
2 years ago, he began. At Liston's insistence, I visited a doctor for the first time in quite a while. There, I was instructed to return for further testing. Upon doing so, I was informed that it was likely that I might be in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. I disagreed with that assessment. I still do. He paused. How familiar are you with Alzheimer's disease? He asked. Ada considered, and then said she knew what it was. She had read about it in some book or other, or perhaps more than one book. It was part of her vocabulary. She pictured it as a slow gray fog that rolled in over one's memory. She pictured it seeping in through the doors and windows as they spoke, invading the room. She felt cold. Have you been back to the doctor since then? Ada asked. Liston glared at David.
No,
he said hesitantly.
What? He said to Liston. There's nothing they can do for me, even if their diagnosis is correct.
You seem fine, Ada said to him, and to Liston, and to herself.
I am, he said. Don't worry too much about this, Ada, he said. I'm quite all right.
Ada could feel the tension between David and Liston. She knew, though she was young, what was causing it. It was Liston's wish to protect her with honesty, and David's to protect her, and himself, with optimism, wishfulness, some willful ignorance of his impending fate.
I think David might have told me he'd be going out of town, actually, said Ada. I can't remember now.
It was a lie. Of course it was a lie. Liston looked at her sadly.
You see?
Said David. But Liston didn't respond. Finally, in the midst of their silence, Ada stood up. She turned to Liston.
I guess I can stay here now, she said.
And she excused herself and walked slowly up the stairs to her bedroom, which was as unfrilled and austere as a man's, wallpapered in a brown plaid that the previous owners had chosen. She'd been reading The Way of a Pilgrim, like Franny Glass, and although she was not religious, she said the Jesus prayer aloud, quietly, 5 times. She told herself that everything would be fine, because she could imagine no alternative. Because no life existed for her outside of David. In a week, the Boston Department of Children and Families came to visit them. Liston had called Officer Gagnon to let him know that David had been found, but they were concerned enough about his disappearance to investigate. David was appalled. He sulked his way through the home visit with a woman named Regina O'Brien, a gray lady with gray hair. To her questions, he gave single-word answers, sometimes unsubtly rolling his eyes. In order to offer an explanation for an absence that had brought the police to their home, David was forced to reveal his diagnosis to the DCF. His first proposal that he had simply forgotten to tell Ada that he'd been going out of town had seemed to alarm them more than it assured them of his competence. Then came a question that David and Ada had not prepared for in advance. Miss O'Brien looked at Ada and asked how she was doing in school. Ada paused. She looked at David, who looked at Miss O'Brien and told her that Ada was doing very well in school. It was not perhaps a lie, if one counted David's method of educating her at his laboratory as school. He had always been hazy about homeschooling Ada. In that decade, everyone thought it was odd and eccentric, but not out of line with the rest of David's odd, eccentric behavior. Everyone, including Ada, seemed to accept that he had worked something out with the state. In that moment, for the first time, it occurred to Ada that perhaps he never had. It must have occurred to Regina O'Brien, too, for she looked at Ada levelly and asked her what school she attended.
She panicked. She looked at David, who said nothing. She thought she should lie.
Woodrow Wilson, she said, naming a nearby middle school, uncertain whether it was even one she'd be sent to.
And what grade are you in? Asked Miss O'Brien.
Eighth, said Ada.
Miss O'Brien paused. And who's your favorite teacher there? She asked. At last, David interjected.
She doesn't go any place. I teach her, he said. I provide an education for her at home and at my place of work.
And from the look on Miss O'Brien's face, Ada knew that they were deeply in trouble. Later in the 1980s, a series of cases worked their way through the Massachusetts courts that would define the laws that now govern the ideas of homeschooling. In Care and Protection of Charles and Others, one will find an overview of what is now required of homeschoolers in the state of Massachusetts. Prior approval from the superintendent and school board, for one. Access to textbooks and resources that public school children use, for another. David and Ada had neither. In 1984, David's failure to enroll his daughter in any school was only further evidence of his neglect in the eyes of the DCF. He seemed not to recognize the severity of the allegations against him. He felt it was impossible that they could take his child from him. Absurd. He told Liston it would not happen. But after that first visit, their lives began to change. The DCF commanded David to enroll Ada in an accredited school. Miss O'Brien recommended to her supervisor that home visits be continued, and social services required David to see a doctor regularly to monitor the progress of his disease, to see whether and how fast he was progressing toward parental incompetence. Incompetence. The word that Liston had once used in reference to him. Incompetence. The opposite to Ada of her father's name. The Queen of Angels School was a brown brick building, four stories high, set close to the sidewalk. One wide short flight of stairs led to six unpretty industrial doors, painted in a dull dark blue. Its roof, surrounded by high chain-link fences on all sides, was used for gym class in warm weather. Its lower windows had metal bars running from top to bottom, added several decades after the school was first built, in an attempt to calm paranoid parents who increasingly saw Dorchester as a place to be feared. And its upper windows were narrower and more numerous than what would have been standard for the building, which gave it the look of a medieval fortress or a city wall. On a Wednesday in September, more than a week after the school year had begun for everyone else, Ada walked for the first time into the Queen of Angels lower school. Liston and David were with her. All three had taken the day off of work. For the weeks following the DCF's visit, there had been a debate. David had wanted to enroll her in the local public junior high, but Liston had insisted that would not do. So, grumblingly, David and Ada and Liston had gone at the start of the month to meet with Sister Aloysius, the principal, and Mr. Hanover, the president, both of whom were in charge of welcoming new students into their fold. In the high-ceilinged office occupied by the latter, the three of them sat and listened to a speech about the benefits of a Catholic education, the moral enlightenment Ada would receive, the community provided by the school. David leaned forward in his chair, his elbows on his knees, looking down at the floor, the top of his bald head catching light from the window and shining. He sat up, stretched his arms and legs uncomfortably, sighed out heavily once or twice. Liston glared at him. Ada hoped that no one else noticed. The two administrators were tactful about her history, referring to her homeschooling only vaguely, euphemistically, as if it might behoove everyone to forget about it entirely. Ada assumed that Liston, who was well known in the Queen of Angels parish and active in the school, had prepped them thoroughly. Ada listened attentively to everything that was said,
looking around with interest at the decorations and the architecture. The crucifixes on the walls, above all the doors, the ancient ticking clocks in metal cages, the colors of the school, which had most likely been redone in the previous decade and consisted mainly of muted modernist tones. Pea green, goldenrod, maroon. She felt in certain ways that she had breached a castle wall. She had so often walked past Queen of Angels and scanned its exterior for signs of what it must be like inside. As outsiders, David and Ada had always been only hazily aware of the ways in which Dorchester was divided, though it interested David, and he often asked Liston to describe it. To Liston, to her children and friends, one's parish was more important than one's neighborhood or one's street. The first floor of Queen of Angels contained the local parish school, a grammar school, perhaps 200 students in sum from kindergarten through eighth grade. But the upper floors contained a central diocesan high school that drew from 7 different parochial schools, including the one beneath it. And so, beginning in the 9th grade, the school widened into a river of students from a broader swath of Dorchester, and some from the city beyond. Nearly everyone in Savin Hill, including all 3 Liston boys, attended Queen of Angels. Maddie and Gregory in the lower school, William in the upper. Liston herself had gone there for her entire education as a girl. This was the only fact about the school that David found at all reassuring.
"Well, I suppose it did all right by Liston," he said to Ada.
But a note of skepticism still made its way into his voice. Ada would enter as an eighth grader, based on her age and not much else, and be placed among students who had known each other for years. But Sister Aloysius assured her that by 9th grade she would blend right in. At one point, she leaned in toward Ada kindly and put a hand on the desk. "Ada, dear," she said, "if you ever find yourself unable to grasp something or falling behind in a course, don't hesitate to come to me for help." At this, David's head jerked to attention, and finally he spoke.
"There is no question that Ada will be able to grasp what you put before her," he said, a sort of quiet viciousness making its way into his voice. "In fact, I'd go so far as to say she'll throttle it. The question is whether you'll be able to provide my daughter with the sort of material that will offer her even the slightest challenge. Or do you," he said, "or do you," he said again. And then he lost his words.
All of them, including David, fell for a moment into silence.
"I can guarantee you, sir," began Mr. Hanover, at the same time that Liston stood up and thanked them for their time.
"Do you have any questions?" asked Sister Aloysius, looking only at Ada. And Ada shook her head quickly in response. Later that day, Liston called to ask whether Ada would like her boys to walk her to school in the morning. She declined, not wanting to saddle them with her, feeling sure that the request would be a burden to them. The recent turmoil in her life had momentarily supplanted her crush on William as the place her thoughts wandered when left undirected. She realized that she had not daydreamed about him for a week. In the evening, David mustered up some energy and made them both dinner.
"Whatever you like, Ada," he said.
She had chosen pot-au-feu, a favorite of hers that David made only on occasion, and went with him to the butcher on Dot Avenue to pick up the beef. She let him amble ahead of her and concentrated on his walk, memorizing it, wondering what it would be like without him. For the past several weeks, she had been investigating Alzheimer's disease on her own, with the help of the scholarly library at the Bit. She had discovered 2 things. First, that the disease typically moved at a fairly sedate pace. Life expectancy in that decade was thought to be about 8 to 10 years from diagnosis. But it had been over 2 years already since he was first forced by Liston to see a doctor. And, if Ada was honest with herself, she had been noticing symptoms of forgetfulness for longer than that. She had been convincing herself for years that David had always been absent-minded.
The second bit of information that she learned, more troublingly, was that when the disease was diagnosed in younger people, its progression was often more rapid. David was 59, well below the age the literature listed as the cutoff point between early-onset Alzheimer's and the more typical variety. And in early-onset patients, the disease could move quite fast, 2 or 3 years until the individual's comprehension skills were entirely lost, until the individual was no longer verbal. After that, quite rapidly, the function of his muscles and all of his reflexes would shut down completely. Ada had squeezed her eyes shut against this possibility. She told herself it would not happen, that David would be the exception. The butcher shop was busy with customers, but the owner knew and loved her father.
"What can I get you, Professor?" he asked.
His perpetual name for David, and for anyone in the neighborhood who manifested signs of formal education. And David, leaning forward, his hands behind his back, selected his cut of beef carefully, brought it home, cooked it up for Ada while she sat in the kitchen and talked to him, her father, her best and most important ally in the world.
"I'll tell you something, Ada," said David.
He turned to look at her, pushed his glasses, steamy from the pot of water he had boiling on the stove, back up on his nose.
"It's going to be a different lab without you there. Quite a different lab altogether," he said. "I know Liston's really going to miss you."
"I'll miss her too," said Ada. She was talking, of course, about her father, just as he was talking about her. Their old and comfortable house filled up with the smell of herbs and onion and garlic, and Ada thought in that moment that it might not all be so bad. Liston had warned her not to be late, so before she went to bed, Ada had consulted the schedule she'd received, noting the start time of all the classes. Her first was at 8 a.m., and she planned on arriving at 7:50 just to be safe. At breakfast, David was quiet. He did not know what to say to her. She could tell that he felt he had failed her. Then he asked, as if it had just occurred to him, what she would use to carry her books, and she pointed to a canvas bag on the floor that she had scavenged from the basement.
"Oh, dear," said David. "That won't do the trick. Wait here,"
he said, and he went into his office and emerged proudly with a brown briefcase that unlocked only when a 5-digit code was entered mechanically onto a rotating combination lock. David had not used it in years, but it had been an object of fascination for Ada when she was small. He had programmed the lock with a number he promised she could guess. As a smaller child, she had spent hours entering guessable numbers. Her birth date, then her birth date backward, his birth date, forward and backward, the address of their house with 3 zeros in front of it, but she'd never guessed correctly. Every now and then still, she walked into his office and idly tried a new idea.
"It's yours," he said to her proudly.
She took it from him. She was pleased. She felt professional, suddenly like her own person.
"You've never guessed the code?" he asked.
Ada shook her head.
"It's just code. The word code, using alphanumeric substitution," he said happily. "No shifts, stupidly simple. The sort of password that longs to be cracked."
Ada had, long ago, memorized a table that listed each letter next to its corresponding number, 1 through 26. She turned the dials on the combination lock, 3 for C, 15 for O, until they read 31545, and then pressed 2 buttons to its right and left, and the latches opened with a satisfying muted pop. Inside, the briefcase was empty, lined with a silk material that was yellowing in places. One half of the briefcase bore little elasticized compartments meant to hold writing implements and notepads, and David now took a pen from his shirt pocket and tucked it into place inside one. He walked back into his office and came out again, holding an unlined pad of white paper,
stationery from the Steiner lab that David had ordered en masse 5 years ago. He handed this to Ada as well.
There, he said. Now you're all ready.
Shall I walk you to school?
He asked her.
I'll be okay, said Ada.
In fact, she would have liked him to. But she wanted to demonstrate to him that she'd be all right, to show him that she was grown up now, to lessen his guilt, which that month had manifested itself in ways that Ada had begun to notice. He looked at her for longer than usual, asked her more often what she'd like to do in the evening or on weekends. A dark shadow crossed his brow now whenever he could not locate a word or phrase, which happened many times each day. The night before, in the middle of a glass of sherry, he had apologized to her.
I should not have put you in the position in which you now find yourself, said David. I was trying to do what I thought was right, but I fear I've made everything worse.
I'll be all right,
Ada had said reassuringly.
Oh, my dear. I feel as if I'm throwing you to the wolves, said David. Genuflecting to the cross, learning the rosary, confessing your sins to Father so-and-so. Good heavens, he said.
He took a pensive sip.
Sometimes I still think I should have sent you to public school, he said.
But Liston knows best, I suppose. He had packed both of them lunches the night before, as he often did. But that day, for the first time, Ada would be taking hers separately, carrying it herself. She put the brown bag inside her briefcase, squashing it slightly when she closed it, feeling the give of the bread. They walked together over the bridge, and then, at the main intersection that followed, Ada turned left, and David turned right.
What is it that I tell you here? Asked David. Have a good day, I suppose.
His face looked pinched, slightly red around the nose. Ada stood apart from him. She did not know how to comfort him. She needed comforting herself. He looked at her ruefully.
Don't take them too seriously, he said finally. Don't take anything too much to heart, Ada, all right?
She nodded solemnly, and then she watched her father as he walked away, carrying his own briefcase down by his side. She longed in that moment to go with him, to run after him, to sigh deeply and contentedly as she settled into her work at the lab. Instead, she turned, finally, and walked in the opposite direction. Her head was down, like David's head. From above, they would have looked like mirror images of one another. One larger, one smaller. A Rorschach test. A paper snowflake unfolded. Two noblemen pacing away from one another in preparation for a duel. It was a short walk to Queen of Angels from there. She tightened her right hand around the handle of her briefcase. It made her feel professional, secure, as if she were clasping her father's hand. When she arrived, she found she was alone. No other students were in sight, and the first floor windows were too high to see inside from street level. Ada walked up the steps, feeling increasingly ill at ease. At the top of them, she tried the handle of a door and found that it was locked. She tried another. Locked. She stood for a moment outside, wondering about her next move. A large part of her wanted to turn and walk home. I tried, she imagined saying. The door was locked. She did not feel yet that she had any obligation to the school. She did not feel yet that she lacked agency or the right of self-governance. In her life, Ada had rarely been told that she could not do something she wished to do, because all of her desires aligned so completely with the desires of those around her. Because her deference to her father and all of his colleagues meant that her requests were usually very reasonable and very small. All of her life, she had operated in the world of adults,
and the world of adults had welcomed her. Now she decided that it was reasonable that she turn and walk home. But as she reached the bottom of the steps, one of the dark blue doors opened behind her, and a low voice issued forth.
"Where do you think you're going?" said the voice.
Ada turned around. The man in the doorway was small and stern. He had gray hair parted sharply to the side of his head and brown pants and a wide, short brown tie.
"Nowhere," she said.
She was surprised into saying it.
"Were you leaving?"
the man asked.
"I was trying to get in," Ada said. "The door was locked."
"And knocking is something you're not familiar with?"
he asked her. She had never been spoken to in this way, so harshly.
"I'm new,"
said Ada, by way of explanation. She began to dig in the pockets of her skirts for her schedule so she could show him, but the man was already coming toward her. Shockingly, he took her by her elbow. She had not ever been handled in this way. He brought her forward, up the steps, pushing her ahead of him as if she might try to escape. And once she was inside, he pulled the door closed behind her with a crack. It was explained to her by the secretary, when she reached the office, that although her first class began at 8 a.m., homeroom was at 7:40 sharp. The front doors were closed and locked at 7:38 a.m. exactly, and after that students were required to ring a bell to be let in, and their lateness was noted on their record. Ada was certain that this had not been explained to her on her first and only visit to the school, but it felt futile to protest. They were so certain of her guilt that it seemed better, more effective, to hang her head and nod. The secretary, Mrs. Duggan, donned her half-moon reading glasses to take a look at the schedule that she still held in both of her hands. She glanced up at the clock on the wall.
8:01, she said. "You should be in Sister Margaret's class right now."
And she walked Ada out of the office, down a short hallway around a corner.
"If you'd gone to your homeroom, you would have gotten your locker assignment. But we should get you to class now. You'll get it tomorrow," said Mrs. Duggan.
Although it hadn't occurred to her yesterday, Ada now noticed the smell of the place. The famous schoolhouse smell she had read about in many of her favorite books. Chalk and soap and dust and metal. She took it in. Overhead, fluorescent lights flickered from time to time, distractingly. She reached Sister Margaret's classroom, and Mrs. Duggan turned to her.
"I'll introduce you to your student ambassador first," she said. "You were supposed to meet her this morning."
She opened the door and popped her head inside.
"Sister," she said, "could I borrow Melanie McCarthy for a moment?"
After a pause, a girl emerged from the classroom and into the hallway. She looked at Ada unblinkingly. She was beautiful. The sort of girl that Ada suddenly and irreversibly realized she wanted to look like. It had never really occurred to her that she wanted to look any particular way before. Melanie had very fair blonde hair that fell back and away from her face, held there by what seemed like a permanent breeze. She had smooth, unblemished skin. Ada had noticed that lately her own had been less cooperative. That was tan still from the summer. Ada imagined she spent a great deal of time laying on a beach someplace, or performing some wholesome athletic activity like field hockey. Her skirt fit her perfectly and fell to the tops of her kneecaps, which themselves were perfect. Her white socks were pulled up to the top of her shins and folded over precisely. Ada was wearing ankle socks, scrunched down by her shoes, because she had nothing else to wear.
"Ada, this is Melanie," said Mrs. Duggan. "She'll be your ambassador here at Queen of Angels."
And Ada could tell by the way she looked at Melanie that here was a girl she approved of. A tidy girl with brushed hair and a family who donated the correct amount each year. The name of the school seemed, in that moment, to apply to Melanie herself. Ada extended her hand ever so slightly, the way she would have upon being introduced to a graduate student, and then retracted it.
a handshake was not correct. She's in Group B with you, so she has the same schedule you do. If you have any questions, said Mrs. Duggan, she's the one to ask. Melanie said nothing. She smiled briefly and looked at Ada inquisitively. She was Ada's height exactly, and their eyes met quickly before Melanie turned them away, back to Mrs. Duggan, who was thanking her for her kindness. And I'm sure Ada will thank you too, she added. Won't you, dear? She nodded. Mrs. Duggan rapped on the glass once with her knuckles and then opened the door. Sister Margaret inside was poised with her hand at the chalkboard, about to finalize some equation. Mrs. Duggan put a hand on Ada's shoulder and ushered her into the classroom. Melanie trailed behind and then walked gracefully back to her desk and sitting, tucked one leg behind the other. Sister Margaret, said Mrs. Duggan, class, this is Ada Sibelius. She's new here. Ada, why don't you tell the class a little about yourself? She and the hallway monitor had both pronounced her last name incorrectly, something like Sibelius. But Ada knew not to correct them. David would have. She had never been certain about how she'd acquired the few social skills that she possessed, which had always acted as a balance to David's lack thereof. Genes, perhaps. The genes of the surrogate mother who gave birth to her. Or her interactions with the other members of the lab. Either way, Ada called upon them not to fail her in that moment, to produce the right response, the right introduction. She looked out into the sea of maroon and navy-clad eighth graders, boys and girls all returning her gaze impassively. She held her briefcase in her right hand and curled her fist around its handle more tightly as she struggled to bring words, any words at all, to mind. She dug her nails into her palms. Anything she could imagine saying felt too far-fetched, too bizarre. I've never been in a school before.